This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The savage wildfires in California became a national tragedy this week and a global worry. It is still early days, but we have the potential for hundreds dead in these strange November megafires. They struck after a long-standing drought, pumped up by climate change, withered the vegetation, and killed 129 million trees in the state. We will start this show with an interview that is so different from anything else you've heard from any other media reports. On the ground from Northern California, literally choking on smoke, I talk with radio host Mariah Gallardon. Meteorologist Jason Salmonow from The Washington Post also joins us. We will touch on possible radiation released in a fire that burned over a nuclear lab site 30 miles from Los Angeles. You know, the place where America's worst nuclear accident happened, and they never told you. I've checked with the L.A. branch of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I will play a short clip from Libby Halevy's show, Nuclear Hot Seat, and Arnie Gunderson. This fire reporting is stirring up my own unresolved angst about fires near my home in British Columbia, Canada, over the past three summers. I almost wept on hearing the situation in California. Tens of thousands of people are temporarily homeless. They're struggling. It sounds like several thousand of them will remain homeless, a new burden for California. Lurking behind all these fires, unseasonably late, driven by hot Santa Ana winds, moving faster than cars at times, is the big one, climate change. I don't need to phone up more scientists to get the facts. Back in 2013, I posted my first show with an expert. It was called The Age of Superfires. It adds up. And for Western North America, and apparently now for Scandinavia and Russia and Australia, superfires are the new normal. Perhaps megafires seem distant to you. Maybe you've been flooded out and loaded with snow already. But we know the smoke will travel thousands of miles, that a lot of people will be damaged not just with their property, but their minds and their hearts have been hurt. A new wave of carbon has been released from the trees to the sky, and that may affect climate change. And the world's fifth largest economy has been rocked by a fearful new reality. Earth has become an unstable and more risky place to live. That is where we have come, in our gas cars and our oil machines and our coal power. Climate change has arrived. It has many frightening faces, and one is fire. From Mendocino County, here's my talk with Mariah Gallardon, recorded November 14th, 2018. We have reached longtime radio producer Mariah Gallardon in Northern California. She's the host of TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness has been on the air for a very long time. It originates in San Francisco, and it is syndicated to other stations. Over the years, we have played several of Mariah's pieces on Radio EcoShock. Hello, Mariah. How is it going where you are?
Hi, Alex. It's smoky here, as you might have guessed.
Yeah. So in a quick email exchange, you talked about being worried of toxins in the fire smoke that's even getting indoors right into your living room. What are you concerned about?
The most recent fire, the tragic fire that's still going on, that burned down a whole town, the whole town of Paradise, 100 miles north from here, where over 7,000 homes went up in flames and many cars. That's been by far the most toxic-looking fire. As you may know, we had two of the biggest fires in the last 2 years right outside my door, the Redwood Valley fire in October 2017, and the Mendocino Complex fire that began in July 2018. And those fires were mostly vegetation fires. So when we did fire watch here from our high point on the ranch, we would sit there and see the white plumes of smoke coming up beyond the next ridge line. And every now and then the plume turned black, and we know now from experience that's when a home went up in flames or a vehicle. And this particular cloud coming down from Paradise that lasted for a week, that was black from the very beginning. You probably all have seen the photos of it.
They're terrible photos. I've collected a few because I never thought I'd see something like that. And as you say, modern homes are filled with chemicals and heavy metals and the building materials and the cars and the electronics and the paints. And now all we see at Paradise is a dust pile, really, punctuated with twisted steel and bits of concrete. What had to happen in Redwood Valley before they could rebuild there?
In Redwood Valley, to my surprise, no house was allowed to be rebuilt unless it was investigated for toxins, and in some cases, like 1 to 2 feet layers of the dirt around the house and in the perimeter foundation, if it wasn't a cement slab, had to be removed. And when I was surprised to see the list of toxins that they were looking for, people said to me, well, your house is made of straw and clay, so that's not very toxic. But what about your solar system? What about your batteries? What about the lead in your batteries? So I am not really living a toxin-free environment either. And I also have to have actually 2 cars to get in and out of here. 1 car that's a 4-wheel drive that gets me through my 3 miles of dirt road when it's raining or when there are landslides, and a smaller car that I use when I have to go to San Francisco. So cars are amazingly toxic themselves. If you look at the photos from Paradise more closely, you see these wrecked cars and you see huge frozen puddles of aluminum, as it turns out, when the motor block melted.
It's astounding stuff. And then, Mariah, when we lose a home, maybe we can rebuild, but when a whole community is wiped out like Paradise was, it's hard to imagine. Can it ever be the same?
No. Many of these people don't even know how to rebuild, because Paradise was a low-income community, and hardly anybody had fire insurance, and the whole infrastructure burned up too. This is actually a new problem. We are hearing from the adjacent cities of Oroville and Chico that they're now facing having to absorb the population. That's 27,000 residents that are now homeless.
Wow.
And they're not even enough shelters for everybody, so there are tent cities going up on parking lots to serve as temporary shelter. And those who were lucky enough to escape in their cars, for instance, a friend of mine who used to work for a local radio station here, she almost didn't make it out in her car. She had about 5 minutes when she realized the world was burning around her to just throw a few things into her car, including her guitar. They're often so moving items people pick up. And I've done that too a couple of times. I was evacuated. Later I thought, why did I pick that? So she got into a huge line of vehicles trying to escape that was in an enormous traffic jam. So the sheriff came by and said, you're faster on foot. And she, in spite of flames now licking at the road from both sides, got out of the car and started walking. And then all of a sudden it started moving again, so she rushed back to her car and was the third to last vehicle that escaped. Some people have their cars to live in, but that's about all.
We've had this locally in the city of Grand Forks, which is the next town to me. They had a levee break in the floods this summer, and there was flooding a whole part of the community was wiped out. The provincial, or what you would call state government, promised a lot of money and aid. We've got your backs, the premier said when he came to visit, but in fact, nothing has really come through. We've got people who are living in RVs that they try and put skirting around the tires or something, but they're not winterized at all, and the homeless situation is terrible. It's really developed that way. But you've raised another problem, and that is whether to get out in your car. And strangely, after the Black Saturday bushfires, I want to tell you a story. In 2009, the Australian government changed their position on staying to fight fires. So many Australians died in their cars trying to get out. And so the government suggested, well, maybe you could stay if that's what you want to do. And there was a similar situation in 2017 in Portugal. 62 people died in their cars fleeing a fire. It's really confusing, Mariah. I mean, personally, if fires come to my place, I'm going to try and get out quick. We have documents and bug out bags, and we've got bins to load some crap on a pickup truck if we have to. I don't know. What's your plan?
You are totally right about that. A car can save you and a car can be your trap. And I observed that too. My personal plan is I'm looking at a mowed area that once a year when the wildflowers are done blooming, I have it mowed with a tractor. And I can't tell you the size of it, but it takes this tractor about an hour to mow the area. And it's fairly well maintained because it's being mowed at the beginning of the summer when nothing grows anymore. And that's my fire safe zone. I offered it to neighbors too to come into. And we had a helicopter land on it on one occasion because it's very mountainous, the terrain here. So this is a rare flat spot. And my plan was beginning in 2008, actually, when I first had to fight the first fire here. My plan is to bring two cars into the center of the fire safe zone, load it with water, and then stay there and defend my house. Because many, many times the spotting and wind throw of embers and little branches could have been prevented from turning into fire if somebody had been there, even just with a bucket and a burlap bag and maybe an Indian pump sprayer or a backpack sprayer. I heard many examples of people who have done that and saved the house, even in paradise. Can you imagine that inferno? Couple of people stayed and had little 5-gallon buckets and put out flames around the house. So that's the plan. But I took note of those changes in policy in Australia, too, because in the 2008 lightning fire here, we were told by the fire department in no uncertain terms that if we were asked to evacuate, we had to leave because we were endangering others by staying, because I don't know if the policy is the same in Canada, but the fire department has to save lives first. And then property, although the way they array themselves, you often think that's maybe not always true, because property, of course, is of high value in this society. But we were told, if you do this, you endanger others. So it's a real dilemma. And the only reason this real dilemma was broken in a way was the 2008 fires that were my first fires. And they were called the lightning complex fires because they were set by a flurry of lightning that occurred in the middle of the night, woke me up. I saw the trees around me illuminated by this flash, bright blue light. And these lightning fires set over 100 fires here in Mendocino alone. So the fire department had more than than they could handle. And eventually they brought in troops from all over the western states. These fires went on for a month. So what we had to do here, we had to do our own firefighting. We could see where the lightning had struck. We went up there with trucks, with containers of water, like 300-gallon containers. Some people on the ranch here had little Honda pumps. We joined the overall effort of creating fire lines. We helped the bulldozers. We put out fires that were smoldering. You probably have seen that, too. The tree looks as if it's out, but then you realize it's hollow in the inside and there's a little smoke rising from it.
Right, or the roots are on fire.
Yes, yes. We fought fires here for 4 weeks as amateurs. We learned a lot.
And, you know, another problem that we're going to see more and more with climate change is evacuation fatigue. I read that the town of Paradise was given 4 evacuation orders in the last 10 years, so some people just don't believe in it. And the same thing when a hurricane strikes, you know, you get the hurricane warning and then, oh, it moved away from the coast, it wasn't so bad. So the next time they get the warning to evacuate and they stay, and some lose their lives because of that. So that evacuation fatigue is another problem that we're going to have to face.
You know what my experience is? You really have to keep the preparation and the organizing up. Maybe in 2008, people wouldn't believe that it would get worse. But by now, pretty much everybody around me, including Trump supporters, they shake their heads when he says, oh, climate change is a joke, because they see it in their cattle, they see it in their agriculture, they see it in their vineyards. They experience it, and that experience is much more important than any Fox News pronouncements. So everybody is aware of this becoming worse and worse. And in addition to that, you know, if you're counting the size and seriousness of the fires, just here for my community in Mendocino County, we had the worst in terms of size and the worst in terms of destruction directly affect us here. So people are organizing to do things because neighbors can help neighbors. In many cases, that's the only thing that will help you, because it happens too fast or it happens on such a large scale that the people who are professionally obligated to deal with it just can't handle it.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, here with California radio host Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio at tucradio.org. Mariah, the stock price crash for California electricity provider PG&E, that follows reports that problems from their power lines may have started at least one of these deadly mega fires. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, I have. And I just reissued a program I recorded in 96, and the person I interviewed then was naming automobiles and power lines as the two main ignition sources to worry about in the forest restoration project he was working on in Mountain Grove. And there were more examples of high power lines igniting. It's maybe too early to call the Paradise campfire for that, but there was a fire under transmission lines. And PG&E is sort of arguing, well, we don't really know if we started the fire or if the fire started the breakdown of our transmission line. But I saw photos of that initial blast that the Paradise, Town of Paradise Fire Department tried to deal with. And it was strangely stretched long, as if something happened along between two pylons along the transmission line. Actually, maybe I shouldn't be saying this. I'm speculating. But I should talk about the Redwood Valley fire that started last year in October 2017. And that was clearly laid to PG&E, as well as the fires that started around Santa Rosa around the same time. And, you know, you can just look into the CAL FIRE or whoever is your local fire agency, and they list the sources. So they often say power lines. They say power lines, automobiles. They say lightning, which surprised me when I looked it up, that lightning still causes about 50% of the fires, but not necessarily the ones that were most severe. There's only one home that burned in the 129 fires that were caused by lightning in 2008. And, you know, Native Americans dealt with lightning fires with ease, and they had no helicopters or fire bombers or fire departments. Those fires usually are relatively mild when they start. They hit a tree, and you can rush and extinguish it before it spreads with minimal technology.
You just produced an updated version of your mini-documentary about Native American forest practices. Tell us about that, and can we learn a lot from the original inhabitants of the West?
Yes, that was, I think we can. And when I first produced it in 96, I was hoping people were to look at the Western forests, the California West forests, and see what was once there and how it could be gotten back. The forests that the settlers found in the early 1800s, or the Spanish conquistadors or church people who came up from Mexico, were extraordinarily open. They had about 15 trees per acre in the Mountain Grove area, where Dennis was counting trees, and now there are a few thousand per acre. They had these beautiful, big, old-growth trees that were not considered a lumber source. They were considered a food source or just a home. And the openness of those forests made the conquistadors say, this is like a park. We can ride our horses right through here, not knowing that their hoofs were treading on carefully tended root gardens that they didn't recognize because there weren't any fences around them. But the Native American forestry here was highly involved in the well-being of the forest. Dennis Martinez was crediting Native American women for setting these small burns. That was the technology they were using. Small, soft burns that hardly ever got out of hand, that were burning for the acorn crops to keep the acorn trees healthy because that was food. They were burning for the basket plants because those were the cooking and storage implements that were needed, and not just even one, like willow or hazelnut. If you look at the Native American baskets from this area, there were dozens and dozens of sources of brush and bush that were used in those baskets. And the landscape was gently modified to produce home and shelter. So now, if the women who did this burning up to the mid-1800s, when it was outlawed by settlers and led to the totally overgrown, junky forests we have now, they wouldn't recognize the forests they want. And the reason I put this program back out was to give some inspiration to people who realize that bringing back fire is actually a wise idea, but they don't always do it the right way. I mean, there was just a controlled burn 2 weeks ago, 16 miles north from here, that got out of hand in spite of fire department standing by. I don't know what they did. I mean, they run around with these little flamethrowers to get things going.
I've been following a guy, he's a professor, David Swain, I think his name is. He's in Weather West is his Twitter handle. And he's been putting up maps about how the fire season has been growing longer and longer, and basically said that if the rains that normally, in quotation marks, came in November had arrived before these recent fires, they probably wouldn't have happened, or certainly wouldn't have happened to the horrific extent that they did, and that the plants were just so dried out that they're all tinder. And then we add into that people building their homes in canyons with just one road in or out, and a lot of population expansion in California. It seems like a bad mix with climate change and more people in that beautiful state.
That's true. We had one rain so far. We often get some rain in this area in October. There's nothing in the forecast. We had half an inch, and we're hoping for more rain between November and March, but it's not sure that's going to happen in any large quantity.
Right. How long has TUC Radio been on the air?
Almost a quarter century.
Just for people who don't know, what can people expect to find on your show?
No, recently I have done more climate change, although I never miss any of your shows. I find that the service you render is really extraordinary, but it's sort of a civic responsibility to cover it, especially since hardly anybody else does. Although it's kind of curious, California is different in some ways. There's actually a state office that's OEHHA. It's the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment. And they have a very interesting, wide-ranging climate change assessment page. And if you're asking yourself, why is it so dry? Why is it so windy? Why are the rains coming so late? Why are the rivers and lakes so warm here? Why are the coastal waters so warm as well? How is acidity rising in those? That's actually all kept track of. Also, the famous snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, that's what's being measured by this office. And you see a picture for the last, especially the last few years, of conditions that are rising that enable fire, dryness, trees dying from the heat. We had 129 million fir trees die in California between 2012 and 2017. And those are standing dead for the most part, an inviting source for fires.
We have the same situation in British Columbia. The pine beetle killed off whole valleys of pine trees, and they were turning red for a while, and now they're gray. And they're standing firewood. The government invited logging companies to come in and take as much as they could while it could still be run through mills. They probably took a quarter of a half of a percent of what's out there. And so we're looking at a couple of decades of super fires here. And so I really feel for the people of California. I know what people there are going through. And from Northern California, within smoke distance of the campfire and the former town of Paradise, we've been speaking with radio host Mariah Gallardon. Thank you, Mariah, and I hope to talk to you again, hopefully, in better times.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Welcome back to a Radio EcoShock special on the Great Fires of California in November 2018. After his career at the EPA, meteorologist Jason Samina leads the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post. He is one of the most influential climate-aware weather journalists, in my opinion, in the United States. Jason, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you think the recent fires in California will be seen as a turning point for the state or for the country?
I hope so. And, you know, I hope that, you know, all of these extreme weather events that we're having or extreme natural disasters, which have climate change linkages, are a wake-up call so that our nation will take climate change more seriously and think about how we can manage the risks and respond appropriately.
Can you give us an example of how climate change could be involved?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the case of the California fires, both the Woolsey fire and, of course, the Camp Fire, which has been so devastating, they were both spurred by unusually warm and unusually dry conditions in California. This has been one of the driest falls on record in California, and the last 5 years in California have been the five warmest years on record. And so when you have these tinderbox conditions, when the vegetation is dried out, it just sets the stage for wildfire disasters, because when you have strong winds you know, coming down these mountain slopes, raging at 50, 60 miles per hour. If you get a spark and the conditions are so hot and so dry, it's just an explosive situation for these fires to consume thousands of acres in a matter of hours.
Yeah, I was listening to a talk by Park Williams. He's a bioclimatologist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, and he says plants are releasing water faster in a warming world, and that must contribute to how dry those plants are.
Yeah, absolutely. What happens is that when you warm up the atmosphere, it increases something called evapotranspiration. So basically, the water which is stored in plants goes from the plants back into the atmosphere, and so the plants dry out, and they basically become kindling. They become fuel for these fires, and the fires just eat this stuff up and burn very rapidly when you have so much dry vegetation.
So those Santa Ana winds can whip wildfires into fire storms. Can you explain how those work?
Sure. So typically what happens is when you have an area of high pressure set up around Utah, Nevada, the clockwise winds flow around high pressure. And so when you get these winds coming from the east toward the west over these north to south oriented mountain ranges in California, the air is forced down the mountain slopes. And when the air comes down the mountain slopes, it accelerates and it also dries out the air. So what happens is relative humidity is dropped precipitously, so you get these relative humidity values in the single percentages, you know, 8-10%, so that the air becomes very dry. You've got this hot wind coming down. So if you have any sort of fire igniting under those circumstances, it becomes an explosive situation. And that's what we saw with the campfire where, you know, things developed so quickly. Emergency managers, they couldn't do anything. All they could do was try to protect people. They couldn't even worry about battling the fires. They just had to try to move people out of the way. And in some cases, because of the gridlock on the roads, people couldn't get out of the way because the fire was moving so fast, and that contributed to the loss of life.
And as you reported in the Washington Post in 2017, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced a record 129 million trees died as a result of the drought in California. Do scientists think that's a one-time loss, or is it part of a longer pattern under climate change?
Well, what we've seen is we have seen a trend towards drier conditions in California, especially during the fall. There's a lot of variability in precipitation year to year. And so, you know, and drought's part of the historical record in California. They get drought. They've seen droughts on and off for decades. But what we're concerned about is that precipitation is becoming a little bit more extreme. In other words, when you get droughts, they're tending to last longer, become a little bit more intense. And then on the flip side, when we have heavy precipitation events, when those cycle through, those tend to be heavier as well. So we're seeing a trend towards more extremes, and that's consistent with a warming climate because when it's warmer, it speeds up evaporation. So when you're in a dry situation, the land surface dries out faster. But when you're when you have storms coming in, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere for the storms to draw from, and so you get heavier rainfall.
Yeah, Daniel Swain said that if the atmospheric river that often hits California in November had come just a couple of weeks earlier, we might not have seen these terrible fires.
That's exactly right. And atmospheric rivers are one of the primary sources for wintertime precipitation in California, and they're instrumental, you know, in terms of the rainfall that California needs for, you know, for its water supply. If and when they get delayed, that can have important consequences for drought, for wildfires. And if we're seeing trends toward drier falls in these atmospheric rivers, these storms that hit the West Coast come later, that extends the wildfire season. And in fact, Swain has documented that the wildfire season's starting earlier and ending later. So we're basically expanding the duration of the wildfire season. So it's almost year-round now. We've seen you know, wildfires blowing up almost every month of the year.
Have we seen, Jason, a switch towards El Nino, and is that a factor?
Yeah, I mean, that could potentially be some good news. So whenever you have El Nino, it does on average, and not every case is the same, but on average, it does tend to increase precipitation in California, and we saw that a couple years ago. So hopefully El Nino will materialize, and that will bring more rainfall this winter, so things won't be quite as dry when the next dry season comes along next summer and we won't see a repeat of these devastating fires. So we've got to hope that the rain delivers this winter and that El Nino does what it does on average. But again, every El Nino event is different. Some deliver more, some deliver less.
And as a meteorologist, you helped build that bridge between weather reporting and climate change. Do you think we're getting to the point where global warming is destabilizing the weather?
Yes, I think it's part and parcel of what we're seeing with the weather right now. If you warm up the atmosphere due to climate change, it affects weather events. And so you see more extremes in heat, you see less extremes in cold, you increase the intensity of precipitation. And so we're seeing that in the statistics now, too, in terms of the number of record highs we're setting, many more record highs than record lows. We're seeing the percentage of the heaviest precipitation events increase. So I think you have to connect the dots, and you're also seeing it with hurricanes too in terms of the amount of rainfall they're generating. If we look at like Hurricane Harvey, for example, or Hurricane Florence, those produced record amounts of rain, and there have been attribution studies which have looked back at those events and found that due to climate change, the rainfall from those events increased substantially, as much as 30-40% in some cases. So yeah, I think you absolutely have to look at the weather in a climate context, because we're not dealing with a stable climate. We're dealing with a climate that's changing, and so that necessarily will affect weather statistics and the intensity of weather events, and you can't divorce the two. They're connected.
Something that puzzles me is, why do you and Chris Mooney and the other staff at the Washington Post get to report fully on climate change when the rest of the media sees it as a side story or just doesn't talk about it at all?
You know, I think it depends on the media organization you're talking about. What we do at the Post, and I think what most responsible journalists do, is they try to mirror the findings of the scientific community. And so because the scientific community has found that climate change is affecting the weather, we report on it. And I think there are, you know, the Associated Press, you know, Seth Borenstein does a great job connecting the dots there and reporting on weather and climate and the connections. And the New York Times has a very formidable climate desk and a team of journalists there that do great work. You've got people at Mashable, at Vox, at Grist, at Slate. I mean, these are all fairly prominent news organizations, some which are more digital, some which are more historical print organizations, which are covering climate, I think, in a robust way. On the other hand, yeah, I mean, there are certainly the opportunities that are missed. Some television networks don't connect the dots as much as maybe is warranted. And so there's definitely room for improvement there. I don't disagree with that.
We have stolen a few minutes from one of America's busiest weather desks. Jason Salmanow is the weather editor for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Jason.
You bet. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Once again, in the recent California superfire, there was a collision between the nuclear threat and climate change. California's wildfires burned over the once-secret Santa Susana Field Laboratory, formerly owned by Rocketdyne. That was the site of a partial nuclear meltdown in 1959, kept secret for 20 years, and still little known to the public. You can see a half-hour documentary about the accident on YouTube titled LA's Secret Meltdown. I'll put a link in my blog. The site is in the hills between San Fernando Valley and Simi Valley, about 30 miles from downtown LA. A top-secret sodium reactor went into meltdown in 1959, releasing radioactivity hundreds of times greater than the 1979 Three Mile Island meltdown in Pennsylvania. There was no containment to protect Simi Valley or LA, and that is long-lived radioactivity. Immediately after the recent fire roared through the site, the State Department of Toxic Substance Control claimed no buildings were burned there and there was no danger to the public. But as you'll hear, some of the infrastructure was burned. And the group Physicians for Social Responsibility asked how the DTSC could know that, considering no samples were taken or tested before they made this release. Nobody can see radiation visibly. There were about 10 other experimental reactors at that site, and former Atomics International employees recall nuclear materials and radioactive equipment scattered around with illegal open burn pits. That was all supposed to be cleaned up by 2017, but of course, it was never done. When I last spoke with Denise Duffield from the Los Angeles chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility this week, she was trying to organize an effort by citizens to collect soil samples to find out the truth. We'll hear more about that in a minute. The original reactor meltdown was kept secret for 20 years and only discovered by accident by university students working under Professor Daniel Hirsch. Dan now heads the community monitoring group for the Santa Susana Field Lab called Committee to Bridge the Gap. And let's face it, nobody trusts the official agencies to tell us the truth after decades of lying about it. The unstoppable Libby Halevy put out an immediate program on this nuclear risk renewed in the recent Woolsey fire in California. Her show is Nuclear Hot Seat, and this nuclear fire special has interviews with Denise Duffield, Arnie Gunderson, and Maggie Gunderson from Fairwinds Energy Education, plus other local activist guests. Here is how Libby starts the show.
The Woolsey fire in the Los Angeles area is a terrifying event, still critically dangerous. As a fire, it's bad enough. But then you learn that it started at the site of a 1959 nuclear meltdown in an uncontained building, meaning that deadly radiation was released into the air and contaminated the land where it has remained on this Superfund site. And then you hear someone who lives near the site and has for all of her life and has been dealing with the consequences of this accident for years tells you.
Once we found out that it was burning at the field lab, we had news footage showing flyovers by helicopters with a rocket stand on fire. And that's when I realized this is our worst nightmare realized. This couldn't be any worse. There's no situation worse to get the contamination to the people than by a fire.
Well, when you hear that from someone who has lived with the Santa Susana Field Lab nuclear nightmare for years, that's when you learn that you and everyone around you is inextricably stuck in that seat. Yeah, that one. The seat we all share.
Nuclear Hot Seat.
You can get that nuclear fire special from nuclearhotseat.com.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Let's think for a minute about what this fire means to the overall economy. As you heard from Mariah, there is plenty of talk about equipment from California power companies starting these latest fires, the most deadly in the state's history. There are signs that the campfire in Northern California, where the town of Paradise burned, began at a utility power line. CNN reports, quote, PG&E disclosed in a regulatory filing earlier this week that it experienced an outage on a transmission line just 15 minutes before the campfire broke out, end quote. The New York Times reported, California utility customers may be on the hook for billions in wildfire damage. In Northern Cal, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, PG&E, could go bankrupt. The lawsuits for damages could be billions of dollars more than the company's insurance. We learn from Libby Halevy that at 2:22 p.m. on Thursday, November the 8th, just 2 minutes before the Woolsey fire was spotted at the Santa Susana nuclear site, the Chatsworth substation owned by Southern California Edison also had a power outage incident. California Edison and PG&E were already saved once by legislation signed by Governor Jerry Brown this September. That law let the utilities pass fire damages on to customers, and it was put in place to prop up the state electric grid after more than $10 billion in damages from the previous record fires in 2017. The new law did not cover 2018 damages, which are expected to go way over the previous $10 billion. Just imagine all those multi-million dollar mansions that burned in the canyons, the schools and hospitals burned out, roads melted, hundreds of thousands of people evacuated, a whole town burned over, possibly with hundreds dead. These fires of November 2018 are going to open up a whole new chapter of costs at a time when the state and federal debt is already into the trillions and individuals are also highly in debt. That could be, in my opinion, the start of a slow climate-driven collapse. Eventually, in some soon coming year, we will be unable to pay to rebuild, to repair, to recover. Then whole cities slip away and stumble, and we still have unheard of staggering costs to transition our society away from fossil fuels as we try to save whatever is left. For now, the state of California has hinted they will bail out the two major utility companies again, just as Japan had to bail out the bankrupt Tokyo Electric Power Company after the nuclear disaster at Fukushima in 2011. That is just the power companies. Countless thousands of Californians are now homeless, and only some of them will struggle back into housing. The social bill to support fire victims will be huge. Companies have been hard hit. At this time, some do not know where their employees and customers are. Some will require cleanup of toxic properties before they can start up. Others have no buildings or truck fleets left. Farms, including giant farms that partly feed the nation, were blackened. Orchards and timber were lost. The list is long. Of course, nobody will try to count the loss of the wild spaces and the things that live there, or the gorgeous spiritual places that are now barren black spots. Fire is cruel. Now look, I've lived in California. There are amazing people there, and the landscape is still inspiring, and it will continue to be a strong place. But we are in the beginning stages of what could be a ramp down, and certainly will be very difficult times as climate change unfolds in its fullness. Now it is time to enter the radio time warp. The next 5 minutes is from my 2013 show, The Age of Superfires. Are we entering the age of super forest fires? Our guest is John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association. He's in British Columbia, Canada, in the gorgeous lakeside town of Nelson, BC. John, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Is there a potential for super fires?
Yeah, I think there is a potential. And to kind of answer your question, not to shorten the interview by any regards, but I think we've already entered the era of super fires, both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, what we're beginning to see are fires of unusual intensity, severity, frequency, and so on, occurring in different forest types across the world. Again, I'm most familiar with what's occurring here in B.C. and in parts of the U.S., but certainly we're seeing the same tendency in Australia. The other thing that adds more severity to these and sort of brings with it a whiff of catastrophe is the fact that human habitat has been encroaching into these forest ecosystems, which are in a certain, we'll talk about a little later, but they're in a not a great state to begin with. And once you begin to embed human habitat like homes and so forth, as well as infrastructure like watersheds and transmission corridors, quite a lot of values are at stake. And so we're seeing loss of infrastructure and lives as well. And communities are being destroyed by wildfire on a scale we haven't seen before either.
Well, so what is new about these fires? We've had fire for centuries. What's new about these?
Well, I referred to intensity and severity. So those are, I don't want to dwell too much on the technicalities of it, but the intensity refers to the energy a fire releases. And severity is the duration, to put it simply, the damage it does in the duration of time it spends burning. What we're seeing, because of the available fuels, and this is a term I'm going to come back to this, because there's so much more wood on the landscape to burn, we're seeing fires burn, as I said, with more energetically, with longer durations, with increasing frequency, and also spreading at quite higher rates than we've typically seen. So fire behavior in many locales around the planet is changed significantly. Plus, these fires are beginning to take on a capacity to be destructive, not only to the communities that we have built in them, but they actually are starting to damage the ecosystems that they are part of themselves. They're actually doing long-term damage to the habitat. These fires are burning well out of the sort of normal range of variability that we might see. We're straying into some unknown territory here, but the balance of probability is in favor of anyone that wants to say we're going to, as I have been saying, see increasingly large fires, increasingly frequent fires, increasingly intense and severe, and the catastrophic outcomes will be felt in many areas, economically, socially, and so forth, and they will be enduring. This is one of our largest challenges I think we face. This is a challenge of such complexity on such a scale that some of the old positions and the old thinking really isn't a match for it. And we're going to have to find new ways of approaching these problems.
We have been talking with John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in British Columbia, Canada. That was Radio EcoShock reporting on the new age of superfires in 2013. Now we go to 2015. Now we hear a bit on climate drivers of superfires from Dr. Mark Cochran, climate scientist and an expert on wildfires and global climate change. He's from the South Dakota State University. This recording comes from a teleconference held by Climate Nexus and broadcast on Radio EcoShock September 2nd, 2015.
They're not changing so much the number of fires as the ability to control these fires. So many of these fires are getting larger every year and impacting more areas. And the way this is primarily working is that with climate change, we have rising temperatures. And when we look across the we've looked across the planet, but the West has large areas that are seeing very significant rises in temperature. This helps increase the fire danger together with relative humidity, drought in general, and wind speed. And the West in particular has kind of the worst combination going for it in that we have significant rises in temperature. We have significant drops in relative humidity that dries out fuels. We have increases in the number of rain-free days. So even if the amount of rain is the same, the number of days where we have no rain is increasing. And then not so much on average, but from year to year, we have a higher frequency of high wind years. So when we have high wind, this is when we can actually make what would be, you know, a significant fire into a very large fire. So things like the Okanagan complex in Washington State right now. So we've looked at that, for example, over the last 35 years, and that's what we see for the West. And this is part of what's driving the growing severity of these fire seasons. Also, as we look forward in time, the chances of this continuing are very high, where we're going to see a lot of increases in the temperature. Greater than 70% of summers are expected to be exceeding the highest temperatures on record for the Western U.S. by mid-century, for example, if we continue with our current emissions path. One of the biggest problems for the West, though, is the snow accumulation, which is very important in the montane regions. And they've been getting warmer and will continue to be warmer, so much more of the precipitation will be as rain instead of snow. So greater than 80% of years are expected to have March snow amounts that are less than what would be median values today. And greater than 60% would have March snow amounts that are below the minimum late 20th century amount, so very, very dry. So this will lead to very dry summers in general. And the high temperatures of the summers are likely to be much higher, potentially up to 5 degrees C higher by the end of the century. So an exacerbation of many things would stress to the trees from these events. So they will have significant die-offs of trees in general from drought. And also this opens up for insects and bug kill as well. So we have a combination of factors that will tend to exacerbate the wildfire situation in the West in coming years.
That was Mark Cochran from South Dakota State University. And next we hear from the firefighters. Retired Captain Lou Paulson was the president of the California Professional Firefighters. This is from the same Radio EcoShock show in 2015, originally recorded by Climate Nexus. Incredibly, the situation Paulson describes 3 years ago could be right on the news today.
I don't need to tell you folks that, you know, the state's on fire, the West is on fire. And I think let me just put it into perspective from an emergency response view and how we are looking at this in California. And to the credit of Governor Schwarzenegger, he established Blue Ribbon Fire Commission to look at the problems when we had the fires, big fires in San Diego a number of years ago. And Governor Brown is continuing that with the climate change task force, and we're tackling these issues, realizing that they are not situational to a drought, but more of a trend of the future. And because of that, I think from the fire service perspective, we are changing how we look at wildland firefighting. It's now not uncommon, and in fact, I would tell you, every firefighter in the state of California, whether you're working on an engine company in downtown San Francisco or Los Angeles, or you're working in the foothills of California or in the hills of California, everybody's being trained on how to be a wildland firefighter and what those hazards are, because we do know that these events are not around just the jurisdiction where they happen, that the resources that are needed are going to be a multi-level government. Very common now to have local government strike teams and firefighters on U.S. Forest National Park property fighting wildland fires, because we do not have the resources. Government does not have the resources at any level to really head this climate change, this wildland fire problem off. And so it's going to take a combined effort. What that ultimately means for various levels of government is that local government becomes more and more stressed, because the fact that while you're sending extra units out to maybe 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 hours from where their jurisdiction is, emergencies are still happening. And it's unfortunately not uncommon that you may send the 5 engine companies out of your own department to a fire in Northern California at the same time you have a wildland fire breakout in your own jurisdiction. So we're seeing more stress and strain on the emergency response system, mutual aid system in California, which is undoubtedly is the best mutual aid system in the world. It's having a lot of problems trying to fill capacity and get resources. And as you've seen, in an example in Washington, they're asking for firefighters outside the United States to come in. We've had firefighters outside California come in the fires already this year. And normally the peak wildland season for California starts in September and runs through early November, although recently that's even become longer and more year-round. So I think from our perspective, we are seeing just more of a fire problem, more of a erratic fire problem. In simple terms, to give you some perspective, when we talk about the high winds that happen, those high winds problem it creates is that it preheats fuel and increases fire spread. So you have spotting in front of the main body of the fire. Those fire conditions become more erratic, because conifers and heavier fuels are usually, in a non-drought situation, are more able to sustain a fire. When they're weakened by drought, they become part of the fuel complex and part of the fuel problem. So we as firefighters see the fuel problem expanding exponentially and becoming more and more of a year-round problem than a seasonal problem. So that's a perspective, at least from the firefighters' outlook on climate change.
That was Lou Paulson, president of the California Professional Firefighters in 2015, describing the situation in California at that time.
Radio EcoShock.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Let us remember those who lost so much in California in November 2018. You can find more links and info in my weekly show blog for each program at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world.